We're all familiar with the way Dogen talks about the identity of practice and enlightenment. Our practice is not a means to an end or a way of getting enlightened, but how practice itself is realization, is an expression of enlightenment. But while we're familiar or comfortable saying that phrase, in a certain sense, the two words are on each side of that equation, practice and enlightenment, are not really self-evident. Today I want to think about the practice side and ask, what does Dogen mean by practice? And at one level, most obviously he means zazen, that the very act of sitting in zazen is enlightenment, or enlightened activity. And yet he's not confining his idea of practice to this form of seated meditation. He wants practice to, in some sense, be all-encompassing, to include everything that a monk does in the course of a highly ritualized monastic life. And because the monastic life is so thoroughly ritualized, there being a form for every activity, and Dogen, you know, takes a lot of flack for even having rules for how to use the bathroom. There's a way in which we can think that that idea of practice means perfectly maintaining the form of the appropriate ritual as you go through your day, whether it's in Orioki or washing the floors or approaching the altar or engaging in the services. And that all these things have a proper way to do them, the same way that there's a proper way to sit in zazen with your back straight. And that it's the enactment of all these roles that adds up to our practice and which adds up to our enlightenment. Now, obviously, the danger in that way of thinking about it is that it more or less gets practice back into a means an end way of thinking, and that if only I get all these things right, or that you get preoccupied with a right or wrong way of doing everything, and you're always trying to make sure you don't make any mistakes. And that mindset would seem to be quite antithetical to Dogen's notion of enlightenment. He amplifies his sense of practice and enlightenment with a couple of key ideas. If I remember the Japanese, one is gujin, which is translated as something like total exertion. The other, I think, is gyoki, continuous practice. And these, again, are supposed to reveal something about what it is to practice in a way that makes practice identical to enlightenment. Now, total exertion or continuous practice, in some sense, again, makes it sound like you're exerting continuous effort or practicing morning till night, whether that means sitting around the clock or, again, engaging in all these ritual practices in just the proper way. And it can create a feeling that of great intensity and great effort, that only someone who does, you know, totally throws themselves into practice, you know, is doing the real thing. And there's certainly a kind of sesshin mentality that seems to go along with that kind of understanding of total exertion and continuous practice. Yeah, Dogen complicates the meaning of these words because one of the examples he gives to describe continuous practice and total exertion, he says it's what mountains do. Mountains continuously practice and totally exert themselves. Rivers constantly practice, totally exert themselves. So we flip these words away from anything that sounds like making a goal-directed effort, which obviously a mountain is not doing. A mountain is not trying to get it right. A mountain hasn't mastered the form of being a mountain after years of screwing it up and trying again and practicing it, finally, after many years, getting mountain down, right? You know? See, but that's, that's sort of the picture of total exertion that we sort of can bring to something like Horioki practice, where it's this complicated ritual that we feel like we're always fumbling through and never quite getting it right, and our mat's never perfectly neatly folded, and so forth. But maybe after years of seishin, you'll feel like, ah, now I really got it. You know, I've got this perfectly done. I know exactly how it's done. You could use me for the illustration in the instruction manual. I've nailed it, right? Well, I think something like that happens, but when that happens, when you've really got it all down, in a certain way, then you forget about it. We might say that at that point, doing Orioki becomes second nature. That we've taken something that starts off being very complicated and artificial seeming, sort of, certainly for us, coming from a different culture. And so we go through a lot of conscious, stepwise practice to achieve mastery. But once mastery is achieved, you do Orioki more in the way you drive a car. You don't think about any of the steps anymore. They sort of naturally flow. And that sense of flow, of something that is so natural to you that it doesn't require any thought, brings us a little closer to something like what the mountain may be doing, which is rather than something that is exerting effort, is rather is something that's expressing its nature or being itself moment after moment. The mountain is constantly manifesting its mountainness, right? It's fully performing its nature over and over again, right? Now, the complication for us is that when we sit in Zazen or do our yogi or go through all these rituals, we're going through a long, arduous, and disciplined training process to make something eventually be second nature, right? So that the whole feeling of seshin, for instance, becomes second nature. Sometimes I tell people that the way to enter seshin is like just stepping on an escalator. You know, just take that first step and let it carry you along. Let yourself be carried through seshin. It's not that you're there to make this enormous effort. It's more that you're there to surrender to the whole experience of it. But what we do in this practice is we do this pretty strange thing that ends up being second nature. And Dogen then sort of says that that second nature, that naturally flowing practice, is enlightenment. This would seem to raise the question, what happened to first nature? See, if we think about a beaver cutting down trees and building dams and building their little houses or whatever you call those things in the middle of the lake, they're engaged in a very complex activity that in a certain sense is continuous practice and requires total exertion, that they, you know, they really have to beaver it up pretty much full time in order to get any of this done, right? Busy as a beaver, all that, right? And apparently we don't think of beavers worrying about the meaning of it all, right? Or questioning the point of cutting down trees or building dams. There's a way in which, like the mountain, they simply and naturally express their nature through this activity. We had a good Dharma lesson to that effect in the bathroom for many years. I'm not sure what happened to it. I think Chris took it away. But we had that little, I think, Larson cartoon of the dung beetle bar, you know, where the dung beetle's sitting in there over his beer, looking mournful and asking the bartender, Is that all there is to life, Murray? Eat shit and die? Yeah. Well, it's the dung beetle bar, and yes, that's what they do. So the question is, again, what happened to first nature? And whether you're the dung beetle or the beaver, we imagine that there's a way to just be naturally who you are, and there's no problem. Now, this doesn't seem to be the case when it comes to people. We have a lot of trouble either identifying our first nature or being comfortable in the skin of our first nature. When Heidegger talks about Dasein, that word typically gets translated as being, and that being is a kind of expression or manifestation, right? And in one sense, it looks like beavers would be an example of being and expressing themselves and manifesting beaver nature at all moments, right? But Heidegger pretty explicitly excludes, you know, beavers and their ilk from Dasein, because he says Dasein is the particular case of being for which being is an issue for itself. I may not have that exactly right, but I think you get the drift, that there's a way in which we have a particular nature that does not seem to know how to unself-consciously express itself. Or we could say that that expression has to include some kind of conscious self-creation, that we have a certain kind of necessary sense of choice and responsibility about what we do for our lives. Beavers don't take, you know, aptitude tests before they go off to beaver college to decide what they want to do with their lives, right? But we sort of end up in this situation where we're not sure who we are, what we're good at, what's going to be meaningful, and how to do it all. You could say that in part, we almost inevitably develop in a way that we experience our life or our psyche as fragmented or in conflict, or having some parts of it feeling underdeveloped, that we don't come out of the womb with a full complement of instinctual capacities that simply spring into place and then function smoothly, you know, the way you can see a baby colt, you know, come out of the mother's womb and just in a very short time somehow get up on its feet, right, and start walking around. To become a human being requires a long developmental process that has no clear and fixed path or outcome. So what we do is that broadly speaking, we say we substitute culture for instinct, that our development comes about because we learn, we're trained, we're acculturated, we adapt ourselves within a social context and environment that engages in a process of being ourselves till we become something, right? Now, the monastic life is one form of this kind of acculturation. And it can typically take young people who are conflicted or confused about who they are or the meaning of their life, who are feckless, impulsive, anxious, undisciplined, and put them through this very rigorous, disciplined form of life that after a certain number of years helps develop a kind of character that feels confident and focused and capable and resilient and not split into a lot of internally conflicted self states. Now you see, after you've gone through that whole formative process and have spent many years at Dogen's monastery, sitting in Zazen will be second nature to you. And at some point you'll be asking you sort of what happened to that whole picture of becoming a monk in order to become enlightened. And Dogen's answer is essentially, you've already made it, you're there, right? That this whole formation has provided you with this second nature, which is the manifestation of the truth of the Buddha Dharma, that this life you're living is the very picture of being in the present, being interconnected, impermanence and Buddha nature all manifesting moment after moment in the life you're living here, right? For the rest of us who are not living a particular form of life that in itself is supposed to be the manifestation of the Buddha way, I would suggest that what practice is doing is trying to return us to our first nature. That there is a way in which Zazen and all the rituals of a Zen center like this do become second nature. And we can settle into a sense of the rightness, the okayness, the perfection of just sitting. But that's not enough for us because our life isn't, in a sense, just sitting. Our life is taking place in all sorts of ways outside the Zendo. And the qualities or the characteristics that we experience in sitting, that sense of completeness, that there's nothing missing, that in some sense, just sitting here goes beyond doing it right or wrong. That sense that we don't have to accomplish anything because we already are who we are. That's what we have to take off from the cushion and bring back into daily life. And it's that sense of not just practice equally being equal to enlightenment, but our daily life, just being yourself, being this impermanent, interdependent human being. That too is the perfect expression of the enlightened way.